From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Unemployment hurts week by week. Ask anybody who's without a job. Year by year, it hurts a whole country. Skills and productivity lost. Friday's March jobs report, with just 88,000 jobs added last month, was bad, just when a lot of people were thinking things might be getting good. Why? The sequester? Something else? This hour, On Point, the economy, the sequester, and the outlook for American jobs. You can join us on air, online. What have you seen in the job market? What's it going to take to make it strong? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We tap them all. Later in this hour, we will remember former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, who has died at 87. We'll hear in a moment from economists Mark Zandi and Heather Boucher on jobs. But first, joining us from Washington is Lisa Rhine, who's been covering the rollout of the sequester cuts in federal spending for The Washington Post. Lisa, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
So how much of this has actually taken place already, Lisa? What's actually happening with the sequester?
Well, the sequester, just for your listeners who may not be following every detail in Washington, are these a set of automatic budget cuts that's kicked in on March 1st because Congress was unable to reach a deal to take down the deficit. The cuts started March 1st, but they have rolled out slowly between then and the end of fiscal year in September. The government is going to be cutting $85 billion in spending. It sounds like a lot. It's actually about 5% of non-military spending and a little over 7% for the military. But because it's being done over 6-7 months, it's actually a lot greater because it's a short span of time.
So we're hearing that this may be related to the bad jobs numbers. We'll look at that. Help us have some sense of what the cuts have been already. I mean, how many jobs have actually been cut on that front, and how are people calculating the knock-on effect of the cuts we've already seen?
Sure. So there's really, at this point, not much evidence, you know, that the actual effect of the sequester is showing up in the economy. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, public sector employment has not suddenly fallen. People who work for the government are not getting fired. But starting April 21st, the first round of furloughs for government workers in some agencies is starting. And these will roll out between, you know, end of April and September 30th. And you have about 750,000 civilian employees who work for the Defense Department who will begin to be furloughed for 14 days.
14 days over 6 months, I guess.
Over 6 months, mm-hmm. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and it's not consecutive days. It's sort mm-hmm. of, you know, one day every pay period. That's probably really the biggest hit, you know, to the civilian workforce. It was going to be 22 days, but the Defense Department got some flexibility in a recent spending bill that enabled it to move money around. But you have the Environmental Protection Agency is doing furloughs. Customs and Border Protection agents, it looks like they may or may not be doing furloughs. Housing and Urban Development, that agency is going to literally shut down on 7 days, 7 discrete days. Mm-hmm. So HUD will not be doing any business on those days. So you have a number of agencies where their costs are largely in personnel that had to take these cuts to those accounts. And for that reason, you know, they couldn't just say, well, let's take these cuts from capital projects mm-hmm. or let's take these cuts from grants. They had to take them across the board. So that's what you're going to see. Now, I would think that, you know, if I were, you know, a federal employee making $70,000 a year and being furloughed for 14 days, I might not be, you know, injecting a lot of new money into the economy, especially if I were married to another federal employee.
We're hearing about employees who essentially would be losing maybe 20% of their pay one day a week over the next 6 months, some.
Exactly. A little less than 20%. Mm-hmm. But it's really significant. And, you know, at a certain point also, this cuts into their sick days as well as their vacation days. This lowers the amount of money that goes into the equivalent of 401k accounts. It's called the Thrift Savings Plan. You know, mm-hmm. for federal employees. Mm-hmm. So, but aside from that, what these agencies that are hit by the sequester, and it's almost every federal agency except for the Department of Veterans Affairs as well as the safety net agencies, mm-hmm. you know, that provide welfare benefits, other things, you know, what they're doing is they're not hiring. So, you could say, well, that has an effect on the job market. People who were in the pipeline, who had maybe done interviews for federal jobs, you know, that spigot has sort of shut off for at least the next 6 months.
What are you hearing people say, Heather, about how it may affect the economy beyond the jobs themselves with the federal government? For example, people are paying a lot of attention to the 149 airports closing down air traffic facilities. Does that have a knock-on effect? Does that have an impact?
Well, by the way, so those airports, where the towers, the control towers mm-hmm. that are manned by contract employees, that's actually been put off for a couple of months, but it still very well may happen. But it's true, you've got people are talking a lot about, you know, the ripple effects on local economies. So you have these airports that employ, I think it's something like maybe 1,500 people, but they tend to be in small airports in rural areas, and these, you know, tend to be lifelines for small communities. And so, you know, you have less spending, you have, you know, rental car outfits, you've got maybe small hotels. And this is definitely not, we're not talking about, you know, JFK Airport, but you have, these are airports with significant stakes in local economies. So that's the kind of thing that people definitely are talking about, especially, you know, where you have furloughs, let's say, for civilian defense workers, maybe in rural areas where you have communities, you know, like at Army bases, let's say, that really depend on the Defense Department. You know, that combined with just a general drawdown that's going on right now in the Pentagon, you know, to defense as the wars are winding down. That's sort of a double, mm-hmm. you know, a double whammy for defense. And also for contractors, that's, you know, another thing that I know economists and, you know, reporters are always thinking about. You know, right now, Tom, we're hearing just really more anecdotal evidence that the contractors, subcontractors, you know, contractors are laying off people. But honestly, it's very hard to get good information on this. And the government is not so great at being forthcoming about it.
We've got budget talks opening up again this week. President Obama and congressional leaders, if they should, this is a big if, but if they should come to some kind of agreement, might it include reining in the sequester, Lisa?
I don't really think so. I think that for now, you know, it's pretty clear these cuts are definitely here to stay in this very inconvenient and kind of inefficient manner, at least through the end of this fiscal year. The Congress passed a spending bill about 2 weeks ago that the president has signed that basically keeps spending going in the government. And as part of that deal, so that Democrats and Republicans could stop bickering and start to look like they've actually done something, they passed this bill, and it kept the sequester intact, although it did give a couple of agencies some discretion to move money around. One of those was the Defense Department, and they were actually Defense has been able to go ahead with some planned investments, you know, some planned weapons mm-hmm. contracts, things like that. But a lot of people here say that, you know, whatever happens with the debate in Washington over raising, you know, the amount of debt that the government can take on, trying to, you know, tame the debt, as many of your listeners know, you know, there's a lot of dysfunction here and a lot of inability for Republicans and Democrats to agree on much of anything. But many people really feel that the sequester, it could actually be here to stay for several years. What people are hoping is that since there is an appetite to really cut government spending, that at least it might be tweaked in some manner so that it's more it's more realistic, and so that agencies have choices, you know, in how they make the cuts. And in that case, you know, this may be better for the economy.
Let me ask you, Heather, you're in Washington, where the economy relative to the rest of the country, I mean, it's kind of boomed while the country, a lot of the country has struggled during the recession, in no small part, overwhelmingly, because of federal spending. Can you see evidence right there in Washington that things are tightening up? I mean, we've heard the president's giving up 5% of his salary, but
right.
Do you feel it? Is Washington feeling it? You're at the epicenter.
Yeah, no, I would not say that Washington's feeling it. You know, the real estate market here is hot. D.C. is you know, started its renaissance. Real gentrification started, you know, probably 6-7 years ago. You know, the recession tamped that down somewhat, but that's really kind of disappeared. And things are really, there's a lot of real estate boom that's going on, a lot of building here.
So the belt tightening is not exactly have Washington,
well,
D.C. screaming yet.
Well, not yet, but the thing is, the local economists are really watching very closely what happens with contracting, because, you know, Washington is very dependent on the government, and that has, of course, insulated the region from what a lot of the rest of the country has felt. Absolutely, but you know, there's a flip side to that. So, you know, defense spending is winding down, and that's sort of a separate but kind of parallel track that the sequester is adding to. And you do have enormous amount of contracting here. And what I think everybody is waiting to see is, okay, what really does happen with contractors? You know, will there be an avalanche of layoffs as spending especially in the defense sector? And aerospace sectors have to you know, cut down.
Washington watching closely right there. Heather, we're up against the clock here. Washington watching right there. The whole country watching from afar and wondering where we're headed. Heather Boucher is, Lisa Ryan.
Lisa covers
the federal workforce for the Washington Post. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about American jobs, Friday's lousy numbers for March, the economy, the sequester, the outlook. And we're asking, where's the work? Got a couple of great economists with us right here. Heather Boucher joins us, chief economist for the Center for American Progress, happens to be in the UK today, joins us from that Cambridge. Heather Boucher, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
And Mark Zandi joins us, chief economist, Moody's Analytics, joins us from Washington. Mark, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Heather, first to you. What do you see in these March numbers? You know, they were, 200,000 plus? People were thinking they'd be pretty strong in March, and boom, here we go, just 88,000. Why?
Well, you know, we've seen an economy that's gone through these little spurts and bursts of strong job gains and then somewhat weakness. We've been seeing this for a few years now. So I think that the fact that it wasn't the strongest gains was not entirely unexpected. But all of the talk about the sequester and all of the austerity that we've been doing in the United States has certainly not been helping the labor market. And I think that last month's numbers were certainly very bad. I think that one of the worst numbers in that report actually was the fact that the share of Americans in the labor force that is either with a job or actively seeking a job is now back to levels we haven't seen since 1979. So folks out there, a lot of folks have given up or they're going back to school or doing other things, some of which may be good for the economy in the long run, but a lot of those folks are just, they've given up and they can't find work. So you asked, you know, why has this happened? Well, it's happened because we haven't seen, I think, the kind of focused policy attention on job creation in the past few years that we need to.
What would that mean in your view? Like, what are you talking about when you say job creation? Some people say get government out of the way and let it roll. Others say get government in there in a big way.
Well, I think I think we would like to see more of the latter. You know, what we've seen over the past few years is a government that's been stymied, an inability to take decisive action. We've seen a lot of these sort of made-up crises over the debt ceiling and other things where Congress has brought the economy to the brink rather than focusing on making the investments we need to get people back to work.
There was a lot of money spent on stimulus. What about that?
There certainly was, and it was effective. We saw it creating jobs, and we saw that money start to dwindle away before we had recovered. You have to remember, this was the worst recession that we'd seen in most people's lifetimes, certainly the worst thing since the Great Depression, and it was going to require a sustained pull to drag us out of it. And what we saw was, you know, this burst of spending starting in 2008 and especially in 2009, but what we saw is as those monies dwindled, we saw these very sharp cutbacks, especially at the state and local level. So you saw government working at cross purposes. And since then, since those monies ran out, we've seen government paring back. What we should be doing is making investments in infrastructure and education and continuing the investments that we're making in green energy. And instead, we're cutting back in education. We're not making investments in infrastructure. And as the earlier segment was talking about, we're closing down air traffic controllers around the country, doing all sorts of crazy things that aren't going to help our economy grow and aren't going to create jobs.
Heather, I want to take it to Mark, but in terms of the shape of this recovery and recession, people talk about all kinds of different shapes. What do you see here? You know, we dropped off. Are we headed back up now? Is this U-shaped? Is this L-shaped? Or, you know, what's the shape we're in?
Well, I think a lot of words come to mind. You mentioned the word lousy. I called the recovery lackluster. I emphasize those because I think they start with an L, and I think that is really what we've been seeing. You know, a number of years ago,
that is drop and stay flat. That's not a pretty picture.
Drop, stay flat. Not only is it not a pretty picture, in some ways it could be the worst outcome, because you know when things are dropping sharply and everybody gets scared, then people they came together in 2009 and took action. But when things are just sort of dwindling along, not really good enough to get all those folks back to work, but not bad enough that the things are actively getting worse, that's when policymakers really sort of stopped taking notice or started arguing about other things like deficit reduction long before really we had actually solved the economic problem. So this L-shaped recovery, I think, is in some ways allowed policymakers off the hook in ways that have been really quite devastating to millions upon millions of American families.
Let me take it to Mark Zandi. Mark Zandi, what's the shape of, if you see a recovery, what shape are you anticipating at this point? And what is that crummy number, 88,000 jobs in all of March, unless it's changed, and it could be revised. What does that say to you about where we're headed?
I'm more optimistic. I do think the next 6-9 months will be much like what we've been experiencing over the past 4 years, moving forward, but at a very slow pace, just because of the tax increases, because of the spending cuts, because of the sequester. That's a pretty heavy weight on the economy. And so we're not going to really gain traction until we're through that to a greater degree. But we will by the end of the year, and certainly by this time next year, the fiscal drag, that so-called fiscal drag, will begin to fade. And I do think the private economy, businesses, will start to continue to do better and hire more aggressively. And one sector, and there are a number of reasons for this optimism, but one sector that should really help is the housing sector. That should really start to kick in by this time next year.
What do you see there that gives you that confidence, Mark? What's brewing?
Well, housing demand, home sales have picked up very sharply, and housing construction is now following suit. And the level of construction, while it's much improved, is very, very low given the underlying demand for housing. When a household is formed, it has to live somewhere, you have to build a home. And we've been building homes at a rate that's well below the rate of household formation. That's now resulting in much better conditions in the housing market and means more construction in the future. And one key point, Tom, is that every economic recovery since World War II has been led by housing. It's very interest rate sensitive. Rates fall during the recession. That juices up demand and you get more construction and housing leaps the way out. Of course, that wasn't the case this go around because housing was the problem. So housing was a very significant drag up on the economy up until this time last year. But now it's turning, and housing is going to take on its more traditional role and lead the way, and I think it's going to provide a lot of jobs. And I think that will become very evident by this time next year when the fiscal issues begin to become less pressing.
A couple of questions there. First, what do you say to people, Mark, who say, well, of course it's a juiced housing market. We've got zero, you know, very, very, very low percent interest rates. That can't last forever. So is it a real housing comeback? What about when the Fed gets a little bit tougher on those rates, Mark?
Well, it is real. I mean, the rates do fall in recessions. They fell in this recession in weak recovery. Of course, the Federal Reserve always is behind that, but that's part of the process. That's the way it works. Housing comes back, provides a lot of jobs in construction, manufacturing, transportation, distribution, financial services, cable hookup, on and on and on. Gets those unemployed workers back to work. And then at that point, the economy is closer to full employment and other good things start to happen and we produce jobs in other parts of the economy. That's the dynamic that we've been missing throughout this recovery. That's the dynamic I think is going to start kicking in full force. Now, ultimately, once the economy is in full stride, we're back to full employment, interest rates will rise, and they should, and that's a healthy sign, not a negative sign. It will weigh on housing, but other sectors of the economy will, at that point, be providing the jobs and income that we need to continue to move forward.
Heather,
this is very typical. This is what happens. This didn't happen this go-around because of the nature of what we went through.
Heather, what does Mark see that you don't? I mean, he sounds pretty robustly optimistic about what, sort of toward the end of this year and into next year. You're talking about an L-shape with a flatness that's unrelenting. What's the difference in your analysis here, Heather?
Well, I don't know that actually Mark was disagreeing so much. Mark was saying that, you know, in a year.
You say L-shape. He says U-shape.
Was he saying U-shape? I think he was saying that in a year that, you know, housing will start to pick up and then we'll start to see the private sector higher. And we certainly have been seeing that. But this drag that we're seeing right now is affecting the level of employment that's going to occur over the next year. Mm. So, I think you've got this situation where for people to go out and to buy those homes and to do all the stuff that Mark talked about, the cable and all the furniture and whatnot, you do have to have people that have jobs that have the capacity to do that. Right now, we have not seen the level of employment rise all that much since the depths of the Great Recession. It's been hovering at around 58% since 2010. So in order for the kinds of things that he's talking about to really take hold, there is a bit of a chicken and egg. And how fast that's going to happen, I mean, if we keep creating jobs at about the pace we're doing, which again, we're not moving backwards, but we're just sort of creating at about the rate that people are entering the labor force, we're not going to see, or a little bit more, we're not going to see full employment for, you know, many years, 5, 6, 7 years at this point. So even if we do see housing come back, which of course we are seeing around the country starting to, although I am a little concerned about the fact that a lot of that investment appears to be on the investor side rather than individual homeowners, or at least there's some
big
evidence
buyers
of that.
Snapping them up, renting them out.
That's not the same thing as having individuals out there buying homes. It may still have an impact on the economy, but it's going to have a different kind of impact and is not what we've seen typically in economic recoveries over the past few cycles. So I think that we should remain very concerned about the low rate of labor force participation, the low level of employment, and what we're going to be doing in the near term to boost that.
Mark, what about it? Lowest labor participation since 1979. That sounds really bad. Can you build a sustaining recovery on that? And is it, you know, do we really have a return of jobs if people are sitting on the bleachers in such big numbers?
No. You're absolutely right. That's a big problem. And, you know, in fact, the 7.6% unemployment rate, which is bad in and of itself, it doesn't, I think, truly reflect the stress in the job market. You do have lots of people who are just disenfranchised. They're stepping out, and that's the decline in the labor force participation rate. So we won't feel really good about how things are going until we create a lot of jobs and employment's moving south, and at the same time, labor force participation rate is rising. So we've got a ways to go here, and I'm not arguing that we don't. And again, I think Heather is right that certainly in the next few months, as we try to digest these tax increases and the spending cuts and the sequester, it's going to feel a bit uncomfortable. But, you know, we have made a lot of progress. We righted a lot of the wrongs that got us into this mess. The private sector, businesses, the banking system, the financial system, even households have done a very good job reducing debt, getting their balance sheets in order, and we're primed for growth. We just have to get to the other side of this fiscal drag without getting derailed by something, and I think the odds are we will, and if we do, we'll be in pretty good shape.
We're waiting, and some people waiting a long time. Let me get our listeners in here, if I may, Mark, Heather. Nathan's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Nathan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
So my main concern right now is just uncertainty, and I'd like to get your guest thoughts about that. You know, some of my customers are government, some of them are commercial, but they're telling me they don't know how much money they're going to have to spend here in the next 6 months. So as a small business, we're doing fine now, but I'm reluctant to grow, and thus I don't want to hire because the customers I have don't know what their outlook is.
And do you lay that on fiscal austerity, or I guess you're saying some of that and some of just private economy also uncertain?
Yeah, we're seeing some good signs, like you mentioned, the housing market. But it does stem a little bit from government spending. I talked to my government customers, and you know, they're still uncertain as how much they're going to be able to spend in FY13. And they might not want to go into a large build-out or something like that.
Yeah, Nathan, let us pick it up. Mark Zandi, small business owner in Cedar Rapids, and he's still this uncertainty word. I've never seen a recession where this word played such a big role. Is that still, if you were in his shoes, Mark, would you still feel that uncertainty at this point? Is it justified? How big a drag is it? And why is it there?
Yeah, it's a very good point, and you're right. Uncertainty has played a very, very key role in weighing on the economic recovery, and it takes on different flavors. The caller mentioned it in the context of the spending cuts, and I think that's very true, particularly for this fiscal year, given the uncertainty with regard to the sequester and how that's going to be implemented. And that's one of the very bad things about the sequester. It's created this uncertainty. But there's other forms of uncertainty, too, that have been created by financial regulatory reform and healthcare reform. I'm not making any comments about the merits of those reforms. You know, I think there's lots of good in both of them, and in fact, it's hard to imagine going through a financial crisis and not taking a crack at reforming the system. But nonetheless, when you make these big changes to two really big parts of the economy, it's going to create a lot of uncertainty and a lot of angst. And we're still trying to figure it out. I mean, these reforms haven't been completely nailed down yet. Lots of rules that need to be figured out. And until they're figured out, small businesses in particular, small banks in particular, are going to be very reluctant to go out and hire and invest. So these are very critical issues. One last thing I'll say, though, to be consistent with my optimistic perspective, I'd have to say that this uncertainty that still is pervades mm-hmm. is much less pressing today than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. And my guess is a year from now, it will be even less pressing, and businesses will feel more comfortable and will start to hire and invest more aggressively.
Nathan, take heart, maybe. Sam in New Haven, Connecticut. Sam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So taking back off of that last comment to some extent, what I'd like to know is why people haven't been talking enough about, I feel anyways, how much, large companies, Fortune 500 companies, have a great deal of agency themselves in the amount of uncertainty that's out there. Many of these companies are sitting on cash reserves of historic levels. They're raking in record profits on a quarterly basis, and yet they still refuse to hire because they're uncertain about what the markets say. But the reason why the markets are uncertain is because nobody's hiring. And to some degree with the Dodd-Frank and ACA, the Affordable Care Act, to a large degree, they put in and argued for the uncertainties in those bills because they didn't want to have to worry about having harsh bills to deal with later. And now they're saying for the same reason they can't, they're uncertain about what's going on.
Sam, our time is short before the break. Let us pick it up. I mean, Heather, Judy says online something along those lines as well. She writes, corporate America needs to invest in people rather than rely on technology and protect top salaries. Our caller Sam looks at those, yes, true, historically large cash reserves. Now, presumably, if they thought they could invest that and make a bunch of money by hiring and building out, they would. But there's skepticism about why all that money is on the sidelines, Heather.
Certainly. So, I think the first comment I want to make is on this issue of uncertainty generally. I mean, I think Mark is very right. I mean, these new laws have been passed. We have financial regulation in law. We have the Affordable Care Act. So we have some sense of what's coming down the pipeline. And now we know that the sequester went through, even though everybody thought it wouldn't. And so there's greater certainty today than there was a few years ago. And certainly as these things sort of play out, there's a greater sense of what's coming down the pipeline. But it is the case that big corporations are sitting on a lot of cash and they're sitting on the sidelines. And I think that, one of the questions that we need to wonder is why they don't see those opportunities for making money. And I would point us back to the fact that a lot of folks don't have jobs. So who's going to be those customers? But maybe we can circle back after the break and talk about why companies don't think they can make money in the same way that they did before the economic crash and what role those new regulations are playing in that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American jobs. We saw Friday's lousy numbers for March. We're looking at the economy, the sequester, the outlook, asking where is the work? When does it show up? Labor force participation has all the way down to 63.3%, the lowest level of the American workforce actually out there ready to participate or participating since 1979. That is a long time. A little later in this hour, we'll hear the voice of Margaret Thatcher, dead at 87 today. Mark Zandi is with us. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, joins us from Washington. Heather Boucher is with us, chief economist at the Center for American Progress, joining us today. And Heather, Mark, we got lots of response from people online. Not everybody is at all sympathetic on the federal cutbacks. Here a listener writes on the website, you know, cue the chorus of violins for the federal employees making $70,000 plus who'll have to sacrifice ever so slightly over 5.5 months. People living that, not so happy about it. Tracy writes to us. She says, it infuriates me when people say the sequestration isn't really affecting the economy. It's affecting my economy directly right now. Tracy writes, my husband works for the federal government. He said to take off 13 unpaid days of leave between now and September, 5% annual pay cut. This on top of a 3-year salary freeze, all because politicians couldn't get their act together. So you got both sides of that. And then just plain old can't find a job. Trudy writes, husband has been unemployed for 2 years, has just stopped looking. There's your labor force participation, as there are no jobs. His age does not help. I'm working full-time and 2 part-time jobs, still trying to make up for $35,000 in lost income. We've had to cut everything. No TV, no phone, no smartphone, sold 2 cars, no spending on anything, and I do not see it getting better. I mean, Heather, that's where the rubber meets the road for a lot of people. It may not be so bad in Washington, D.C., but Trudy's up against it right there, and a couple of years of that will really get a family's attention.
Certainly, and you hear these stories all across America, and you also see it, you know, among older workers, as that email was indicating, but also among younger workers, teens, people leaving high school and college and not finding work, and those kinds of effects can have a lifetime scarring effect, not being able to get that first job, get their foot in the door, get that job experience that's going to help somebody move up the ladder. So this is all, you know, fairly devastating to families, and The reality is that, you know, these stories are heartbreaking when you hear about a family that's lost, you know, that has a breadwinner who's unemployed, and what that does to their family economics. But of course, that also has a devastating effect on communities and on the economy writ large. That family isn't out there consuming at the same level that they were before the recession. And because the rules have changed, for both, you know, good and bad, they won't be able to borrow in the same way that they could before the recession. And so you're seeing a lower level of demand. You're seeing a level of demand that U.S. consumers cannot maintain in the same way that they could before the crash, because you have fewer people at work and because you don't have the same access to credit. We can't just continue to live on borrowed money as we were prior to the crash, which I think is one reason why companies aren't making those investments. They're sitting on cash because before they were relying on consumers who were borrowing a lot more than they were to keep up their spending. And now we all just can't do that. So there certainly needs to be a lot of steps taken to fix this. And, you know, I just don't think, you know, to go back to the theme here, that I just don't think that the sequester is really going to do us any good and is only going to prolong the pain that we're feeling out there in America. And that's going to prolong the pain even longer as we see young people not getting the right start, as we see preschool teachers being laid off around the country and all the other horrible things that are happening that mean we just aren't investing in our future.
Mark, I want to bring this structural question to you. Let me get a call first. Christy in Simsbury, Connecticut. Christy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Christy. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Christy?
Well, you know, there are jobs out there that could fulfill the unemployed. There may not be all the jobs to fulfill for the unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
However, I noticed companies, especially recruiting companies, are not contacting potential employees that are unemployed, which are the really individuals that really needed the job.
Does that include you, Christy?
Yes. And I've been unemployed now for 4 years, and I've been searching all over. I've been temping here and there. I've been looking for part-time jobs, just, you know, like cashier jobs or barista jobs or waitressing jobs.
So you're ready to do just about anything. How do you survive 4 years without a job? How do you even do that, Christy?
Well, luckily, one of my spouse still have a full-time job.
Yeah.
That's how I get by, and it's not, you know, easy when you got one spouse working and the other spouse is, you know, not earning and kind of earning.
Yeah, no kidding. And it sounds like you're ready and able and willing, and it's just not happening. Christy, good luck with that. Let me get one more. Rich in Hamilton, Massachusetts. Rich, you're on.
Hi, I'm a 58-year-old unemployed, disabled veteran. I've been unemployed for 3+ years, and I've tried all sectors.
Yep.
And the sequester has done nothing but make it worse for me, as it's basically about 6 months ago I started getting the notices about how a job has been closed and without being filled in the federal sector.
Mm-hmm.
It's also affected the NGOs and international sector jobs. Private sector, I'm dealing with age discrimination as well as in the federal sector. So I'm double damned.
It sounds like you're up against it, Rich. What's your plan?
Calvin Coolidge said persistence pays off, and that's all I've been doing, you know. I just keep trying in all three sectors, private sector, public sector, and federal sector.
Hang in there. That again, 3 years, 4 years, these are brutal lengths of time. Mark Zandi, what is it going to take to pull people like Christy and Rich into the labor market? I mean, you hear that's a hellacious long time. You know what it's like to live with that, or maybe you don't, but you can imagine it. A lot of people have said we have a structural problem. We're not going to get back to that big-time, robust employment that pulls everybody in.
Yeah, no, the structural unemployment issues are serious. So Chairman of the Federal Reserve Bernanke, often makes this point, and he uses a statistic that's very telling. That is, 40% of the unemployed, and of course there's a large number of unemployed, mm-hmm. are unemployed for more than 26 weeks. And so if you're unemployed for that long, it becomes increasingly difficult for you to get back into the labor market, that employers start to wonder, you know, what's wrong, why can't you work, and it just, your skill sets begin to degrade, and it's harder for you to get back into the labor market. So this is a very, very serious problem, and it's why Chairman Bernanke's been working really hard through monetary policy to try to stimulate the economy, get those interest rates down, help support housing, the rest of the construction sector, and support stock prices, get the economy moving forward. But he also makes another good point, and that is that fiscal policy, and this is, you know, where the sequester comes in, it would be wise, you know, it's very important to get our deficits down and to start making progress in reducing our debt load. We need to do that. But we need to do this in a slower, more orderly way. We're trying to do too much too fast, and that's doing damage to our economy. That's why the next 6-9 months are going to be so difficult, because we're trying to digest some very large tax increases and some very significant spending cuts, and it would be much more prudent to do those cuts, to raise that tax revenue, but do it over a more extended period of time to allow the economy to adjust in a more orderly way.
As I listen to you,
the way to approach it through monetary and more rational fiscal policy.
But as I listen to you and to Heather, Mark, Heather seems less confident of that demand coming back to really get us back into a robust position here. You seem to think that Housing Plus will get us over the hump, but with this very low labor force participation rate, with this problems of growing demand, and you've got so much, you know, so many are just kind of cut out, is there a risk that we just settle into something, you know, where part of the economy is working and a big chunk of it is not, and that creates an ongoing handicap for our employment situation?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a risk. There's no doubt. I mean, you know, after such a wrenching downturn in 4 years of weak economic recovery, you know, one can't state anything with confidence. But we have made a lot of progress. That, you know, our businesses, American companies, are in amazing financial shape. Their balance sheets are very strong. They've lowered their cost structures. Their profit margins have never been wider, and they're highly competitive. They've done a really good job getting everything in order.
Does that translate into jobs, or does that just make them invest, I don't know, somewhere across an ocean and off they go?
No, it will. It will. I mean, we do need to get through the other side of these fiscal issues,
mm-hmm.
you know, the tax increases, the spending cuts. But with each passing year, the private sector businesses are engaging in hiring and investing more. It's hard to see it, because of all the fiscal drag that we're struggling with. But underneath it, the private economy is doing better and better. And once the fiscal drag fades, and it will by this time next year, the better private economy will shine through, and we will see many more jobs and a lot better jobs.
Heather, fiscal drag will fade by this time next year. What's your confidence level?
Well, I see a scenario. I mean, I look at the same data that Mark does, and I see a world where corporate America is doing really well, and the stock market's doing really great, and that is not trickling down. It just doesn't work. We have a failed economic model that seems to think that you cannot grow the middle class, not create jobs, and yet you can have economic growth, and you just can't do it. It's not sustainable. So I don't mean to be so pessimistic. I mean, I would really like to see us creating the kinds of jobs that would, put those families that we heard from back on their feet. But until we do that, we are not going to see a strong and sustained economic recovery.
Well, two different views right there. The best case, looking out a year for the fiscal drag to go away. And Heather, worried about structural issues beyond that. We will watch. We will see. And thinking about those people who are up against it right now, a year is a long time in our kind of best case scenario here. Heather Boucher with the Center for American Progress. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And Mark Zandi, Chief Economist at Moody's Analytics. It's always great to hear from you, Mark. Thank you for joining us. In a moment, we remember Margaret Thatcher. This is On Point. Margaret Thatcher, the first woman to become British Prime Minister, died today at age 87. In the 1980s, alongside U.S. President Ronald Reagan, Thatcher was a towering, polarizing figure, a tough, no-apologies champion of moral absolutism, individual liberties, and free markets. She once famously declared, "There is no such thing as society." In a moment, we go to London to remember Margaret Thatcher. First, here she is in one of her most famous speeches, her The Ladies Not for Turning speech, to her Conservative Party conference in October 1980. In the speech, in her familiar, iron-willed, unapologetic Thatcherite tone, she laid out her vision for the future, for what she framed as a stronger Britain.
If our people feel that they are part of a great nation, and they're prepared to will the means to keep it great, then a great nation we shall be and shall remain. So, Mr. Chairman, what could stop us from achieving this? What then stands in our way? The prospect of another winter of discontent? I suppose it might. But I prefer to believe that certain lessons have been learned from experience, that we're coming slowly, painfully, to an autumn of understanding. And I hope it will be followed by a winter of common sense. Yeah. If it isn't, we shall not be diverted from our course. To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies not for turning.
Margaret Thatcher, 1980. She's died today at age 87. Joining me now from London is Elizabeth Rigby, Deputy Political Editor for the Financial Times in London. Elizabeth Rigby, thank you very much for being with us today.
Pleasure, Tom.
You must be getting wall-to-wall coverage of Margaret Thatcher's passing in the UK. What's the tone of it? What's the range, Elizabeth?
Well, she was a very polarizing politician, very polarizing indeed, but actually the coverage today has broadly been positive. Everybody from all political parties have been very respectful of her, recognized what a transformative leader she was, and people have come out and said we might not have agreed with some of her policies, but we recognize that she was probably the greatest peacetime leader in Britain, and therefore we should use this day to respect her rather than attack her.
And why do people give her that status? Is it because of her iron will? Is it because of her appeal to the stiff upper lip? Is it because of her policies, Elizabeth?
I think it's probably all of those. I mean, what a wonderful clip. I mean, it shows the personality of the politician, doesn't it? But she came in to power in the UK in 1979. The British economy was in a mess. Society was in a mess. And Margaret Thatcher had a very clear ideological vision of what she wanted Britain to be. And I was a child, actually, growing up under Thatcher in the 1980s. And for all of us who grew up with her or who were young people when she was leader, you know, for all of us, we can't really imagine what Britain would be like without her.
But eventually she had rebellion inside her own party. She had unrest in the streets. What about that side of the legacy?
So because what happened was she said, I want to create a neoliberal agenda for the UK. Mm-hmm. She rolled back the frontiers of the state. She privatized. She lowered the tax base. She did, you know, she did things that now is common parlance between in liberalized societies, that this is how you run an economy. You're talking about sort of the end of her tenure. She was ousted from power effectively in 1990 by her own MPs. And of course, she was very polarized, and part of the rolling back of the state also engendered, sort of discontent from the left and from other pockets of society where, you know, she said there is no society. So, that you know, her reforms brought things like high unemployment. They brought hardship upon people. Towards the end of her political life, her dogma and her conviction in the end came back to haunt her because, as you said, she began to not listen to people around her, and eventually her own party decided that enough was enough, and they got rid of her.
But praise for Margaret Thatcher today at her death at 87. Elizabeth Rigby with the Financial Times. Thank you. This is On Point.